All right, you're listening to part two of the celebration of the United States Coast Guard, 230 years, 1790 to 2020.
So here's the Coast Guard marching song. We sing on land or sea, through surf and storm and howling gale, I shall our purpose be. Semper Paratus is our guide, our fame and glory too. To fight, to save or fight and die, aye, Coast Guard, we are for you. So here's the Coast Guard marching song. We sing on land or sea, through surf and storm and howling gale, I shall our purpose be. Semper Paratus is our guide, our fame, our glory too. To fight, to save or fight and die, aye, Coast Guard, we are for you.
I, in putting this together, I was swimming in the memories, no pun intended. As a Coast Guard person, you do some swimming. But I keep thinking back to when we were young people doing this, and I mean young relatively here or there. Obviously, everybody's a little bit, you know, spaced out in age. But with the timing, that 80 to 84 time frame that I was in, was really the end of how the Cold War was wrapping up. And for people who weren't around then, it's kind of like, what do you mean was the Cold War? Well, if you were around then, you know the times that at that point, Russia was public enemy number one, and how times have changed. And now there's, you know, a rotating group of public enemy number ones in the 21st century. So, but I have such vivid memories from that time in that you know, space of 4 years there. And the people that I spent the time with in this particular second episode of the celebration of the Coast Guard, phenomenal to me. Chief Dickman and God, Gary Butler, who's a subscriber of the show, Mike Hicks, who was really in so many ways the ringleader of the Coast Guard Air Station Chicago gang, you know, has an award for extreme heroism. He kind of glosses over it when he tells a story about doing a rescue, but he was given a commendation for extreme heroism. And he's gone on to run basically the city of Cordova, Alaska for God knows how long. And, you know, those type of things, those kind of people, they are the fabric, they're the backbone, they're the glue that holds things together wherever they go. I just got a text last night. You heard Brenda in the first episode. I got a text from her last night, and she had donated her Coast Guard to this women's museum, and she's standing next to this mannequin that's wearing her uniform. And I just, how does she must feel to know her uniform is hanging, you know, along with other women in this museum. I mean, it's amazing stuff. And then there's Kurt Erickson, who was Chief Warrant Officer Erickson last time I saw him. Such a well-traveled guy. 20 years he put in the Coast Guard. And now he travels mostly on a motorcycle, which isn't a bad thing. And of course, then there's Gary Butler, who I only actually served with for a year, but he's so unforgettable, this guy, you know, and so well-respected with his time in the Coast Guard and an integral part of actually putting this together. He's a subscriber of the Life 2.0 podcast, and he actually was able to bring in Petty Officer Blanco, who wraps up this show. He is currently on duty with the Coast Guard and in maritime law enforcement, a rate that didn't even exist when we were all in. So anyway, enjoy this second iteration and episode of my celebration, remembrance, and congratulations for 230 years. Well done, Semper Par. Hey, Chief, it's Augie.
How you doing?
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Saldana. How are you?
I'm doing good. What are you doing?
I just got in from working in my wife's flower garden. I'm a flower gardener.
You're a good man.
I must be stupid.
So listen, there's two reasons for the call. One is just to see how you're doing, and the second is all these years in radio. I don't know if you know this, but I got into podcasting about 5-6 years ago, and in podcasting, just radio, you know, through the computer. It's a different format, but same stuff, different delivery system. I thought I'm going to put together a podcast for the 230th anniversary of the Coast Guard on August 4th and start making phone calls to people I spent time with and just get their thoughts. And I thought I'd give you a call, see how you're doing, and if you just wanted to participate.
Oh, go ahead, shoot, Luke.
Okay, Chief. So my first question to everybody is, how did you come to joining the Coast Guard? Everybody's got their own routes, you know, to the racing stripe. How did it happen for you?
Well, I was the third person in my family to join the Coast Guard. And then they offered a really good electronic training program. It was one of the highest rated at the time. And I knew that if you could qualify, they'd send you to advanced electronic training. And I was lucky enough to get that and went up to Milwaukee School of Engineering for 2 years. And
yeah,
it's really a high-quality school, so I really lucked out there.
What year was that?
Yeah, 73 through 75.
So then you went from there, and how did you work your way into the aviation end of it?
This is really unbelievable. When I joined up, I didn't even know the Coast Guard had airplanes.
Uh-huh.
So I was in basic electronics school. I was, somewhere maybe in the middle of the school. I think it was a 24-week or somewhere in there. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And the guy came in and asked if anybody wanted to become an AT instead of an ET.
Uh-huh.
I said, what the hell is an AT? He told me, he said, well, it's an aviation electronic technician. And I said, do they go on isolated duty? Which ETs did a lot. They went on isolated duty for a year.
Yeah.
He said, no. So I raised my hand immediately. I said, sure, I'd love to be an AT. And all we had to do after graduating from ET school, you had to take 2 weeks of radio school. A week or 2 weeks. I can't remember what it was.
Wow.
And you had to get up to, I think, 8 words a minute on Morse code.
Huh.
And I'm telling you, was that weird? You know, you listen to that all day long. I mean, you would walk, if you walk somewhere, you could hear the streetlights, you know, hear, well, that's a da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, stuff like that, you know. That was in your hand 24 hours a day. Well, then, going out of this AT program, and we graduated as an AT-3. It was AT-3 Striker AT. So you were the AT-3 AT. And most of us got the choice of a duty station.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I thought, well, shit, Traverse City would just be ideal for me.
Yeah.
So I told we were like, we were going to get married as soon as I got home from ET school. And I thought, well, we're probably going to Traverse City, Michigan. We'll be close to home. I got home, surprise, surprise, we're going to San Diego, California.
Wow.
And that was the greatest thing that ever happened to us.
Really?
Was just, oh, God, what a beautiful place that was. There I was just... I think it was 3 months later, I was an AT, just an AT-3. That was a no more ET. And I was qualified as a navigator, a radio operator, and a radio operator on a Grumman Albatross.
Whoa.
I don't know if you've seen the pictures of those.
I have. That's a serious aircraft.
They're the most reliable, tough airplane. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So... And being in San Diego, got a tremendous amount of flight time. And then, of course, we worked in avionics. And I was really fortunate. I was always with good people. The chief I worked for at that time, and this chief I had, he was, wow. I mean, straight arrow, straight, day pressed, hard worker, and really cared for people. He was a great person. And when I was in San Diego, I made... about a year after I got there, I made second class. And then after 4 years, I slipped up. I re-enlisted, and I made first class.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was offered a at that time was, I thought, was a pretty good bonus that I re-enlisted. It was something like $5,000 or $6,000, and
wow,
67, that was a good chunk of money.
Yeah, it was.
I was the luckiest person to ever join the Coast Guard.
Why do you think you were the luckiest guy?
Well, first off, I didn't have to become an ET. Became an AT. I got stationed in San Diego, which was just heaven. I mean, it was so unbelievable. And there, the weather was perfect. The flying was great. The crew was great. And you were busy. I would say the first couple of years, we stayed 24 hours every third day. And boy, did you work hard. I mean, that was a hard working place. And then we played hard. We played, if you were off during a weekend, you could play intramurals against the Marines or the Navy in the area. And we played football against a little bit of basketball.
Yeah.
And fast pitch softball. And I was there almost 5 years.
How did you end up in Chicago?
Well, they opened the station in 68 or 69.
Yep.
And I was due for, a transfer. There's no doubt about it. And I thought, well, what the heck? Well, I'll go to Chicago. And so I put in for it. And lo and behold, there I was.
Huh.
And we were at a commissioning detail.
Huh.
And 68, 69. I know that I was there when the Cubs blew the pennant that year.
That would be 69.
So I think that was 69.
That was 69.
Yeah, and then from there, I went to Milwaukee School of Engineering. Hmm. At Ottoman's Milwaukee School of Engineering, I went to Air Station Miami.
Okay.
And that was a very hard-working place. It wasn't the same as it was in San Diego. Hot, humid.
Yeah.
And we flew our butts off, let me tell you.
And then you came back to Chicago?
Yeah, probably in 77. I was off the commission, but I would have been put on I was going to be an executive officer on the Loran station in a loosened chain of islands, and I can't remember what it was, and our son was at the age where it wouldn't have been good for me to be gone for a whole year.
Yeah.
So I turned down the commission, and when I did that, I seemed to piss a lot of people off.
Not you.
No, so who do you think you are turning down this opportunity,
Yeah.
So I did, and all of a sudden I was in Chicago again.
Huh.
I met this great guy named Augie.
So I came in 80, and I didn't realize, I knew you had been there for a few years, I didn't realize you were there once before and kind of came with the furniture.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, me and Bob First were there the first for the commissioning.
Yep.
And I think Doug Wenzel was there for the commissioning. He did two tours there.
Oh, I remember those names.
I seen a little thing on TV the other day, and boy, the Coast Guard's got some fantastic helicopters and airplanes now.
I was going to say, the 52s were just starting to kind of be phased out in the 80s, and they bought those 65s in it, like a Corvette compared to the 52s.
Yeah, I know it.
And now you look at those, and you think, wow.
That's amazing. And, when I was in San Diego, we had, at that time, we had a Sikorsky helicopter, which was called an H-04F, or an H-19, depending on if you were Air Force or Navy or whatever.
Yeah.
But ours were designated an H-04F, and that had a radial piston engine in it.
Jeez.
And you talk about a piece of crap. I mean, it had no power, no endurance, and, but in 65, I think it was. We got the H-52s in San Diego, and I got to spend, I don't know, a long time at the Sikorsky Aircraft Plant going to school on the 52, on the H-52.
Mm-hmm.
That was in Stratford, Connecticut. And I can't remember exact year that was. It had to be 66. No, 65. Wow. 1965, I went to Stratford, Connecticut. Sikorsky Aircraft Factory. What a deal.
I bet you knew that bird inside and out, huh?
Well, yeah, I think I knew more about the Grumman Albatross.
Okay.
I guess I was more impressed with it, because that was when I was a rookie, that was it,
But was there ever one of those moments where you're kind of like, damn, that was close? You were, especially, I know you put hundreds of hours in, in the air. Did you ever have any kind of SAR missions that were really close for you guys?
When I was in San Diego, I can't remember what year it was, there was a high-ranking Army officer, Marine officer, one of the other services, flew to Hawaii, and he crashed out in the ocean somewhere. So he was so high-ranking, so there was a lot of people flying. So I was on a crew. We took a Grumman Albatross, and we flew out of San Francisco, and we would fly the maximum that you could fly. Then you had to take time off, and all we did was fly, sleep, and in 1 week I got 54 hours of flight time.
Oh, golly.
And we were out there, and we were way out at sea. But the Grumman Albatross, I remember, could fly for 13 hours.
Wow.
And it was low. It was low flying, searching, and we never did find anything. Nobody found anything. But we were out there, and the pilot we had was kind of a cowboy, you know.
Yeah.
And the we didn't call the guy an engineer. He was a flight mechanic. Flight mechanic kept going up and checking the fuel load, and you know, talking to him, you know, we're be heading back, you know, we're running low on fuel. And we finally got him to turn around, and he turned around to Sam, and my navigation, we were at the point, we better make it right to San Francisco, no screw-ups, no nothing. And we got just out of San Francisco, and I don't know if you've ever been there, but the fog can roll in there like
sure.
Soup.
Yep.
And luckily, we got in it, and we landed, and we turned off the runway onto taxiway. One of the engines quit, ran out of gas.
Oh, man.
That was, and yes, talk about luck, huh?
Yeah, you are the lucky.
And that pilot got in a little bit of trouble, and come to find out, he got more trouble further on down his career. But he was a wild one. We called him Crazy Ed.
Oh, God. We spent a lot of time together, Chief, back in from 1884. And I don't know what possessed us, but, you know, we used to go running at when we had Jocks and Socks, which was a 90-minute break in the day. And whatever possessed us, we were going to run on the airbase, but we didn't run in gym shoes. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
We ran in boondockers. Everybody was trying to do something that was different. I don't know what possessed us in the heat in the summer on concrete to go running in our boondockers, but I remember that.
Yeah.
Was there any big ahas or thoughts about your 20 years in outside of hauling calves back and forth on the weekend?
I just enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed flying. The only thing that I didn't care for was when we hit kind of like cold water survival in Lake Michigan. That was colder than something.
We were talking about that with Brenda. You know, it was so funny. Remember once a year, we had to go out, and they put the raft up, and everybody had to go in and do the training out in the lake. And Ted Young and those guys would get everything ready. And we'd go out there, and Brenda hated the water. And we used to try to figure out ways to get her from the helo to the raft without getting her wet. It was great.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling, bud.
Good talking to you, Chief. Take care.
Yeah. Say hello to everybody.
Will do.
Good morning, John.
Hey, Kurt, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Well, I was sitting here dialing the phone thinking that probably the last time I heard this guy's voice was 1980.
Yes. It's been a while.
Oh, my, oh, my. You know, it's one thing about Facebook that's great. You get to keep tabs on people that you've spent time with over the years. And it's like, do you ever get off the motorcycle or what?
I do.
That's great.
Yeah, I do, from time to time.
So, you know, I'm just trying to get a well-rounded kind of conversation around, you know, our branch of the military, which is often misunderstood, overlooked, and underappreciated. And,
yes.
You know, how did you come to even joining the Coast Guard? How did that happen for you?
It's a very interesting story. In the summer of 1970, I went in and had my physical as part of the draft. And time had passed by. About a month after I took the physical, the fellow I was working for said, "How are you doing with the draft?" I said, "Gee, I don't know." He said, "Why don't you give them a call?" And so I called the draft board that morning and talked to the lady there. She said, "Just a minute, let me look for you." She came back on the line a couple minutes later. "Your draft notice will be in the mail this week."
Mm-hmm.
"Oh, thank you."
Glad you called, right?
So, yes, I'm glad I did. And so that afternoon, I started calling around to the recruiters. And at that time, there weren't answering machines. The Air Force recruiter wasn't answering the phone. Okay. So I went and saw the Navy recruiter. He said, "Well, we'd like to take you, but we can't take you for a couple months right now." Okay. Then I looked across the room at the Marine recruiter and said, "Not for me." So later that afternoon, I called the Coast Guard recruiter. They said, "Come on down." At that time, I really didn't know what the Coast Guard was. I'd seen them in episodes of the old TV series Sea Hunt.
Oh, my God.
But that was about it.
Yeah.
But it was enough to, you know, pique my interest to at least look.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down and met with the recruiters and took the battery of tests. And they said, when would you like to come in? We can take you next week Friday.
Wow.
I said, that works for me.
Wow.
As the mission of the Coast Guard, as I learned, many missions were more appealing to me than the other options I had.
Right, right.
So I joined the Coast Guard and took my first jet airplane ride out to California. Took my first helicopter ride from San Francisco International Airport to the Oakland Airport.
Right.
And found myself in beautiful Government Island.
So you're an Alameda guy too?
Yes, I am.
So you didn't go. So back in the day, so you were in Mississippi. What, is that your home state?
No. At that time, I was living. I'd grown up in Minnesota.
Ah.
And there were, I think, four or five of us who joined that day. My father and my oldest brother were able to see me sworn in to the Coast Guard, which I think was pretty neat. But that first morning in boot camp, the bugler played reveille. I woke up and asked myself, "What have I done?"
I understand.
But over the years, I learned to really appreciate the Coast Guard, its missions, its traditions, and I hung around for
how many years?
Most every day, a little over 20 years. 20 years.
Yeah, Coast Guard Air Station Chicago was the first place that you we had to snap a salute to you. Is that right?
That's correct.
How did that feel going from? But you worked up the ranks. How was that for you? To go in from, you know, Alameda to the other air stations, to go to East City, to go to school, to go to aviation school, and then put, you know, some gold on your cap and have that transition and have to be, you know, you were enlisted, but you know both sides of the coin. What was that like?
Well, it was different, but at the same time, it was very enjoyable having the enlisted background.
Right.
I built up, you know, a number of, you know, personal relationships, working relationships with both officers and enlisted men. And so it was kind of like straddling a fence where, you know, you're working with people on both sides as a middle manager. It was really fun because, you know, as a warrant officer, you have, I guess, well, people picture you as being this gruff old guy, technical expert. You know,
right.
Here I was, you know, just barely in my 30s.
You were, Kurt, you were a gruff young guy.
Yeah, I guess so. But it was fun being in basically a middle management position, a technical position. In Chicago, all of a sudden, having been in electronics, here I am, a helicopter maintenance officer, and assistant department head. But I found it to be very enjoyable. Working with all the different disciplines, as a maintenance manager, and it was really fun. And being able to work with such a great group of people, many of whom I keep in touch with today via Facebook.
Yep.
It was just so much fun.
Yeah, I think that...
especially at such a small unit where we had 13 officers and pilots and about 23 enlisted men at the whole station.
For a station that size, it was so much fun. And like you said, 13 officers and pilots, and then you got 23 enlisted. Everybody kind of squished together in a really nice hangar, by the way. And not only was it great fun, but it was really like just a large family for everybody that was there.
Exactly. It was more of an extended family, but then, that was how I viewed the Coast Guard, just an extended family. Where especially in the aviation side of the business, at that time, I think there were 3,500 officers and enlisted men in the aviation side of the Coast Guard.
Oh, my gosh.
And so wherever you went, if you didn't know people, you had mutual friends.
Somebody knew somebody.
Well, when I showed up at Chicago, we had Ted Young, just all the other people like Mike Hicks.
Oh, yeah.
Stationed with him in Traverse City also. Then George Ferguson came.
Yeah. We lost Fergie about 2 months ago. You know this?
Well, yes, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, his brother and I stay in touch, and I call his mom every now and again, who's more of a coastie than any of us. But
I think so. Marianne is definitely Coast Guard mom.
Yeah. I know this is a near impossible question, but I ask everybody who's on: is there like a mission, a moment, an event that stands out more than any of the rest in your 20 years?
Yes, there is. Actually, there are two. One occurred while I was stationed at the Coast Guard Air Station in Kodiak, Alaska. I had duty one morning, and we also had a personnel inspection that day. And so everybody basically showed up ready to go to the inspection in their dress uniforms, and the SAR alarm goes off. For a boat sinking halfway between Alaska and Hawaii.
For people who are listening, Kurt, who don't know what SAR alarm means, what does the SAR stand for?
Okay, it's a search and rescue alarm,
right,
indicating that there's an emergency condition that requires our response. And at that point in time, the people who are assigned what they call the ready crew, the people who are scheduled to go out on such missions that day, get ready to go. The airplane prepared, do all the mission planning, and get started and to deploy on that mission. And for us, we got everything wound up, and there was a decision that, no, we didn't need to go. They were going to use some other assets in support of that mission. And then about 10 minutes later, after everything was shut down, they said, no, we need you to go. So we had to get everything started up again, get all the aircraft systems up and running. We were topped off with fuel. And so we flew to a point halfway between Alaska and Hawaii, in the middle of the North Pacific Ocean, where a freighter bound for Japan from Oregon had a load of lumber that was stored on the decks shift, and the ship sank. There were about 40-knot winds that day, 50 knots, 30, 40-foot seas. This was in a Coast Guard C-130.
Oh, I was just going to
ask. Four-engine turboprop aircraft.
Wow.
And so there we were. When we arrived, a Navy patrol aircraft had been on scene. They had located the men, many were sitting on piles of lumber that were still bundled together on the ocean.
Wow.
And so we were there. We had loaded extra life rafts and other equipment in our airplane. And basically, we delivered everything we had and stayed on site, flying over the survivors of the sinking as long as we could until we were relieved by another aircraft. The nearest ship was still a day off.
A day?
And so we departed the scene and went, spent the night refueled and slept on Midway Island. And the next morning we went back, and I'd been tracking the debris, if you will, and determined the approximate current and direction that everything was moving. We relocated everything, but unfortunately, we could not locate any survivors the second day.
Oh, man.
And the ship's captain and I think two others had managed to get into a life raft, and they were rescued. But there were only three survivors from that whole sinking. It was very, very sad because that.
Just
looking out of the windows, looking at the men sitting on those bundles of lumber, to know that they perished overnight.
Kurt, the nearest ship was a day away. That ship would have had a helo on it to go grab those guys?
No. Actually, it was a Navy ship.
Oh.
It was close by, but they did not have that helicopter.
Okay. Boy, that's a rough one.
And the other event that comes to mind is one that occurred the day of the Chicago Air and Water Show in 1985.
Can't wait to hear this one. Go ahead.
Well, that you've experienced the Air and Water Show as a, quote, victim, unquote.
Yes, I have.
We were there. We did a hoisting demonstration in front of the crowds off Coast Guard boat. And then we were heading back to Glenview Naval Air Station. Well, that day we had a pilot, flight mechanic, and myself. I was flying as an observer. And we were called to, we got a call from the air station saying that there was an overdue windsurfer north of us. And so we changed missions to a search and rescue case.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it was a search. And we were able to locate the windsurfer about 8 miles offshore.
Can you just hold on a second with that? Because I don't think people get, you know, it's one thing to be in the Pacific or the Atlantic, but Lake Michigan is basically an inland sea, is it not?
It is. I mean, you look at the history of the Great Lakes with all of the shipwrecks that have happened over the years, including the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald
yes.
in 1975. And, I mean, it is, for all intents and purposes, you know, an inland sea, as you say.
So 8 miles out is an eternity if you're on a board at all.
When your horizon is only perhaps 2 miles away, 8 miles offshore, standing on your windsurf board, you can't see anything but water around you and sky above you. But fortunately, we were able to locate the gentleman and bring him back to the beach.
Is there a big takeaway? I mean, this is another loaded question after 20 years.
It could be very, very rewarding. You know, not everybody had the opportunity to go up in the helicopter, rescue the people. But, I mean, there were so many people who supported the missions, whether it be the people in the supply department, people maintaining the station. Everybody was an important part in doing the job. And you know, not everybody can go out there and get their picture in the paper.
Right.
But everybody plays still plays today an important role in getting the job done.
Cordova Police Department.
Yeah, I'm calling for Chief Hicks. This is Augie in Chicago.
All right. One moment.
Thank you.
Hello?
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 Mike.
Is this the person to who I'm speaking?
Yeah, it's me. It's me. It's Ernest T.
How's it going, man?
I bet I haven't heard your voice since Reagan was president.
In 1986 was the last time that's when I left Chicago.
Wow. So I don't know how this is all going to turn out. We'll see where it all goes. But here's what I know, and everybody said the same thing. You got to have an anchor man. If there was one guy that kind of sum up, not just time in the Coast Guard, but time at Coast Guard Air Station Chicago, it got to be Mike Hicks.
Why is it always me?
Because it's you, and you know it.
Okay.
You know it. Come on. Listen, I always felt like whenever we were there, like you always knew something the rest of us didn't, and you never said it. They had all these guys running the station, but we all knew that you were running the station. Let's just call it what it is.
Well, I was getting paid to run the station.
What are you doing, paperwork there?
No, I'm just hanging out here. I retired here a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
But then one of the guys had to go on leave, so they're shorthanded, so I was filling in for a few days.
Yeah, very cool.
So, yeah, I just finished up here. I'm still the volunteer fire chief here till at least April.
So we're trying to keep track of all the things you've done, like chief of this, chief of that. You've been the mayor up there yet, or what?
Not the mayor, but I've been the city manager. I filled in on it for about 4 months with that.
And you wonder why we thought you ran the air station. Come on.
Well, I kind of got my way.
Yeah, you got your way. So I went to your page, you know, on the Facebook page, and it says November 18th, 1974 was the day you joined the Coast Guard. So how did you get in? How did this happen for you? Everybody has a story how they got into the Guard. How was it for you, Mike?
Well, I was working for Westinghouse at the time, and they were looking at laying people off. And the way that the union was back then, if you went in the service and came out of the service within a certain amount of time, you would get your job back with seniority. So I said, well, heck, I've got a year here now. I'll go in the service and do 4 years and come back to my factory job and, you know, you have all this wonderful experience. So I went to the different recruiters and talked to the Coast Guard, and they seemed like the most legit. So I decided to go with the Coast Guard, and then was in a couple years and decided that I like that better than working in a factory for 30 years and made a career out of it.
Yeah, but so how did you end up in aviation? Because everybody that I've talked to, except for, you know, a couple of the pilots like Jerome Beck and Muncy, you know, they all started out in different routes and ended up in aviation, which is actually, I mean, the Coast Guard's small as it is, but the aviation section is really small. How'd you end up there?
Well, I mean, I always wanted to fly, but I was on a small boat station out of New York. And we were out there on a 44-footer just getting pounded, searching for a missing boat. And, of course, the helicopter from Brooklyn at the time, they had the H-52s in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. They were helping with the search, and they were out there. And, you know, after about maybe an hour or so, they turned around and left. And I said to one of the other guys, well, where are they going? Oh, they're going home. They're done for the night. I says, how do I get that job? Really, I put in for aviation, and back then that was toward the end of Vietnam. Yeah. And so as things were winding down in Vietnam, people were bailing out of the service because the draft was over and the war was over. And
yeah.
And so the aviation stuff and a lot of the rates started opening up, and I put in for aviation because I was a mechanical kind of a person, and I put in for aviation machines made school, and I was gone a couple months later.
Wow, as that fast.
Yeah, it was that, you know, now I guess it's a couple year wait to get into these schools, but back then they were wide open. And
wow.
The school, and I was E3 when I went to school, came out of school, an E4. Yeah, I made E5 about 12 months later, and yeah, I just made a career out of it.
Where did you go out of school? You didn't go right to Chicago, did you?
I went out of school. I went to Traverse City. Mm-hmm. Spent 2 years there. That's where I met Glada.
Mm-hmm.
Spent 2 years there, and I wanted to go to the West Coast, and so I mutualed with a guy in North Bend, Oregon. Went out there for 3 years and did a lot of stupid stuff. And then I went to Chicago because Glada's dad, his health was starting to fade a little bit, and mm-hmm. figured I'd go to Chicago for do a tour there. And then, of course, you were there, and they kept threatening to close the air station.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And so they kept extending everybody. So we did 5 years in Chicago. Then I went from there. I went to Alaska and was in Kodiak for 3 years, came to Cordova during the oil spill in 89.
Uh-huh.
Left here in 93, and they sent me down to Savannah in Charleston to open the air facility down there like they have here in Cordova.
Uh-huh.
And then retired in 95.
Man. I mean, that's quite a journey. I mean, you're recounting it like it's really fast, but it really, there's so many twists and turns in there. And
And there's side trips to the Olympics and all kinds of things that happened along the way.
Oh, I know. And you were always getting the good news.
And I owe him a couple for that one.
I'm sure you do. And he'll probably...
Well, no, the remember the 84 Olympics?
Sure, in L.A., right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was Keith Roth and put in to go on to be on the Olympics task force. And so this was like in January. I come home, I told my wife, I said, yeah, they're looking for a couple of volunteers to go to the Olympics. And I says, you know, I put in for it, but they only want like one guy in my specialty. And she's like, whatever. You never, like, you know, women, they never. So here it is, like, I don't know, May or June. And I left the station. I'm heading home. Before I got home, Kurt Erickson calls and talked to my wife, says, hey, is Mike home? No, he's not home yet. Well, I just wanted to call him and congratulate him. He got picked to go to the Olympics. And she says, why the heck do you guys always make him go on these trips? Isn't there somebody else that can go? And he says, well, he did volunteer. What? So needless to say, she was waiting for me with both barrels when I got home.
Oh, I'm sure. And I was just thinking, I wonder how many times in all the years you were in their service, Glada said, whatever.
Yeah, really. And it's like, you know, I said, don't you remember? She said, no, I don't remember. I said, okay, well, whatever. So I went, spent 6 weeks out there and had the time of my life. And I bought her an above-ground swimming pool for the yard because it's hotter than heck in Chicago in summer. So her consolation prize.
Yeah, that's a good prize. And, you know, you brought up Keith Roth, who passed away a few years ago. And, you know, there was a lot of nicknames on the base. And I never figured out why we called them Lumber Wagon. Do you have any idea?
Lumberwagon, that was that, he had that Plymouth Fury, or he had that car that was all beefed up. He called that the Lumberwagon.
Oh, there was like some discarded landing lights he put on the front. You remember that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like an off-road Plymouth Fury, I think, of an off-road Plymouth Fury. He was more of a motorhead than he was an avionics guy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we were out at the Olympics. We got a little bit of time off, so we drove to Vegas, and because it's not too far from L.A., we drove to Vegas, and he'd never been to any place like that. And we show up there, and he's wearing corduroy pants and a long sleeve flannel shirt because he's from Wisconsin.
Yeah, hey there.
And it's about 100 degrees. 100 degrees. In an air-conditioned car, he gets out, he's dying, and we're standing in front of one of the big casinos there, and I remember him saying, there's more lights on this whole building than there is in Eagle River, Wisconsin.
Man, oh man. You know, everybody I've talked to pretty much came to the same conclusion that even though Coast Guard Air Station Chicago was of high military bearing and professionalism, basically every day was like Animal House.
Pretty much.
Yes.
Another good one was you were on that one. We went over to Grand Haven for the Coast Guard softball tournament.
Yeah.
And they were a Coast Guard city back then. Yeah. But Cordova just became a Coast Guard city here this past year, which is kind of cool. But
yeah,
back then we went over there, and I had a pickup with a cab over camper, and I don't know, we must have had 10 guys packed in that thing, and we drove from Chicago to Grand Haven. And we got over there, and of course, we were bare bones back at the station. We just had the duty crews to cover in case somebody actually needed to be saved. We had to have somebody people fly out.
While we're playing softball, you know, get our priorities straight.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, so our pitcher was John Chazaro. He was the chief.
Yeah. Chief
Chaz. He had to work, and he couldn't be there and take the road trip over. So right before we started to play ball, here shows up a Coast Guard helicopter, and there's people out on the field playing. They cleared the ball field, and the helicopter landed in the outfield, and off jumps John Chazaro with his softball uniform and his glove on.
I remember that.
I said, who's that guy? It's our pitcher. He's got his own helicopter.
I remember.
He took a training flight and flew him over there.
I remember that ride all the way from Chicago up there in that back of that pickup truck, because you only had the little slider windows, you know? And we're trying to get some ventilation back there. Is this like we're being smuggled across the Michigan border here? It was hilarious.
Yep. Oh my God, it was fun.
But I recall we had some libations in the back, so we didn't go thirsty.
Yeah, I know. The libations were getting a little carried away because it was the truck was rocking pretty good.
But wherever time, listen, I know that you've been on some search and rescues that were dicey at best. Does anything really stand out about the mission or any of the missions that you had where you thought, you know, this is some shit here?
Yeah, there's a number of them. I mean, the one that when I was out in North Bend, when I ended up jumping out of the helicopter, that's back before we had rescue swimmers, pulled a guy out of the surf out there. And, that was dumb, but it worked out.
Yeah.
And you know, going out, I remember flying over going back to Chicago, we were flying out over Lake Superior. We were doing some work on the lighthouse out at Isle Royal. I forget the name of the lighthouse out there, but it's about 60 miles over open water. And we were watching ice form on the bell mouth on the intake on the engine.
Mm.
And it kept getting bigger and bigger because our engine anti-ice had failed. And had it broke off and gone through the engine, we'd have been in the lake.
Whoa.
So we got out there, dusted it off, and mm-hmm. fixed it, turned around, came back. But that was an interesting one. And I could go on and on. I mean, you know, we used to get a lot of our business when the airport was closed, and we'd go out in the middle of the night. And, mm-hmm. and yeah, a lot of good memories. Definitely a young man's game.
Yeah.
Too scared to be scared, I guess.
You know, we were talking about, and I'm pretty sure this is you, and if it wasn't, then it's you now. That I've, you know, every time we did the air show, somebody had to be the victim and volunteer, right? And mm-hmm. so we did the air show probably 82, 83, somewhere in there. And I volunteered to be the victim and get a day off. And we go into the ops center and go over everything. And we had that old grease board, duty board up on the wall there, right? And,
yep.
And I actually ended up with that. My kid has it in his basement, of all things. I don't know how I ended up with that when I left and they put a new one up. So anyway, we went in there and did the whole thing, and this would have been like June is when they did the air show. And we go out, and you know, the guy gets on the loudspeaker, "Here comes the Coast Guard, blah, 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 blah." And you guys, "Well, how do you want to get picked up?" "I don't care, whatever." So decided on doing a platform pickup. So I dump off at, I don't know, 15 feet above the water, whatever it was. And I'm thinking it might have been Mike Hicks that changed the water temperature in the op center on the board and put it at 70,
yep.
70. You admit it.
I remember it now.
Now you're right. It was like, yeah, you wrote 72. It was like 63. I had.
I remember that now, yeah.
I had no wetsuit, no nothing, just a flight suit. You know, I didn't even think I had shoes on or anything or socks or nothing. I hit that water and I thought my legs came off.
Yeah, we briefed beforehand before the flight.
You remember
here's
this.
Here's the water temperature, yeah.
And
yeah, it was like 73 degrees or something. Yeah, I remember that now. Yep. Guilty is.
There's only one guy that would do that, and you're talking to him today.
Run out on that.
So, yeah, right. Any long-lasting kind of takeaway ahas from your long career? You know, Mike, you've seen, you came in 74, and you really worked your way up the ladder, and, you know, no pun intended. I mean, you did really some incredible things. Everybody, including myself at the station, really looked up to you for a lot of leadership things. Had the guard changed a lot from the time you got into you left, and and any big takeaways from the career that you had?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I was a wildlife trooper here for a number of years.
Of course.
With the last troopers. And we went out on a fisheries enforcement for a shrimp commercial shrimp opener here on the Sound. And they stuck me on the Coast Guard cutter Sycamore to work with the Coast Guard guys so they could do their federal law enforcement and I could do the state law enforcement. So they put me up in chief's quarters, and we got underway. And it was amazing when I was standing on the bridge and watching what was going on, the discipline, the camaraderie, everything, it was still there. And you go down and you're sitting in the galley, and everybody's talking about the same things. Their last station was their best station, and their new station is going to be their best station. The chow is either really good or really not so good. So a lot of that's never changed. It's just they were about 20 years younger. And then the same thing, I'd go out on searches with the helicopter crew from time to time, and they're sitting there going through the checklist and watching what's going on. It's like, you know, put me in, coach. I can still do this. It's all still there. It's amazing. And the professionalism is absolutely amazing. I don't know if they do the same stuff we used to do when it's playtime. I doubt it. They all end up in jail. But no, I think it has grown into a really, it always was a professional organization, but it's really, really grown into a very, very professional organization. Our military as a whole has. And I remember when we were in Chicago, we were on a Navy reserve base, which is no longer there at Glenview. And they had the Navy P-3 squadron, they had Army helicopters, and they had a Marine unit and the Coast Guard. And we were always the bunch that got kicked around in the corner on the base, came to sports when we'd have softball or football tournaments, and we'd always beat up on everybody else on the base.
That's right.
We had some really good athletes, and they had a lot of heart.
Yep.
A lot of good memories.
There was something about how I think we worked together and how we played together that really made it such a unique thing. We didn't take ourselves very serious, but we took the mission serious, and that was a big thing.
That's exactly. And I think I've pretty much been that way throughout my careers, plural. Mm-hmm. You gotta take some time for yourself, and you gotta have that play time in there. But you gotta take the job and the mission seriously, because and I think that's another thing about the Coast Guard over the other services. Some of the other services, they have people that fix the planes, and then they have people that fly on the planes. Well, we were fixing the planes, and we were flying on.
Right.
Your work, your life depended on your work, because if it breaks, bad things happen. Well, here's one, too. I remember it was, I think it was Commander Redinger, who was the XO.
Yep.
And, you know, we'd have some slow days, and the guys would be sitting around watching TV in the afternoon, watching the Cubs games. And he said, I remember he came out with a kind of a directive saying, look, I don't want the guys sitting around doing nothing. If you don't have something for them to do, cut them loose and give them a little bit of liberty.
Uh-huh.
And okay, so I just don't want him sitting around watching TV. So I was out with Rick Yotto, was a pilot, and I don't remember who the co-pilot was, but we were out and we were flying around downtown Chicago, just, you know, burning up fuel. Basically, we had our approaches and everything like that done. So we went and did a little sightseeing, and we used to kind of hang out by the Sears Tower, up by the observation platform, and people would be taking pictures of us as we fly by out there.
Yeah.
And then he says, hey, let's go out. Let's go check out the Cubs game.
So, oh, no.
So we flew over Wrigley Field, and, you know, we just did a flyby, high enough altitude. And, of course, I don't think we were supposed to fly over, like, really heavily populated areas in a single-engine helicopter. It's not a really recommended procedure in case you have an engine failure. But flew over there, and next thing you know, we hear the ops desk on the radio, what are you guys doing down at Wrigley Field? And so Yotto got back on the radio saying, what are you doing watching TV? I think the guy's name was Kraft. It was one of the warrant officers.
Wow.
Actually had been over to the base barbershop, and the game was on in the barbershop. And Harry Carey gets on there, and he says, it's a beautiful day here in Chicago. Even the helicopters are out watching the game. And they zoomed in on the bottom of the helicopter, big USCG flying by. When I got home, my neighbor even told me he saw the helicopter.
That's hilarious.
nobody ever got in any trouble for it, but it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Lesson learned. And that's back before they had cameras everywhere like they do now. Yeah.
Anyway, you know, we can wrap it up. Any final thoughts?
Working in Chicago with you guys, that was probably, I mean, I worked with a lot of great people over the years, but that was probably the best group of people. I think in my Coast Guard career, it was just such a small knit group of people, and everybody worked together. We worked hard. We played hard. We were professional at what we did. We took the job seriously, but we also took the fun time seriously. And I think that's stuff that lasts a lifetime.
John.
Hey, Gary.
How you doing?
My first question to everybody, so might as well get rolling, was, so, you know, you've told me this story a couple times, but let's just rehash that. How did it come that you ended up in the Coast Guard?
As a young man in my early teens, I spent a lot of time out on Cape Cod, a lot of weekends and summers. And as I got a little older, I think it was about spring of 68, a good friend of mine that I was in high school with, he was a year older. He said, "Hey, I'm going to go up to the talk to the Coast Guard recruiter. Why don't you come with me?" So we went up, we talked to the recruiter. He had a specialty that the Coast Guard was interested in. He did a lot of boiler work, and at that time, all the ships had boilers, so he was a perfect fit. And the recruiter said, "Hey, why don't you take a test same time?" And I said, "Oh, I still got a year and a half to go for high school." He said, "That's all right. I got a 2-year waiting list almost," because Vietnam at the time was going hot and heavy. So anybody that had some intelligence, they wanted to get in the Coast Guard. So I took the test. At that time, you had to score at least a 95 before the Coast Guard would consider you. And I think as a junior in high school, I scored a 97. And he said, "Okay, when do you want to go?" So I picked out September 29th of 1969.
Wow.
And yeah, it's been over 50 years since I joined.
Wow. Man, oh man, 50 years.
And it at the end of my, right out of boot camp, I was stationed on a ship on the upper Mississippi out of Dubuque, Iowa. Working aids to navigation. We covered from Dubuque all the way up to Minneapolis, St. Paul. And we're usually underway for 3 weeks every month, except for in the middle of the winter, we were frozen in the ice. But it was just a 12-man crew, but it was like a big family.
Right.
And it was a tremendous experience.
Wow.
But from there, I got lucky and got aviation school, and my first station was up in Annette, Alaska, which you tell everybody in Annette, they're like, "What? What's that?" It was a very small island. There was an Indian reservation at one end and Coast Guard at the other end.
Wow.
There was like 11 miles of paved road, and that was it.
Jeez.
But from there, we covered halfway up to Kodiak, doing fisheries patrols mostly at that time. And a lot of search and rescue with the helicopters, and occasionally had to go up to Kodiak to help out with law enforcement up in that area when they ran short of 130. So we did a lot of flying and had a lot of fun and a lot of hard work.
So,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you said you lucked out getting into the aviation. I don't know anybody actually lucks out of it. I think that there was... Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit more goes into that. So let's just roll back a little bit. How did you luck out into going into aviation?
Well, when I was on the ship, the captain, he was a W-4 bosun, but it was a small ship, 125-foot tender and 125-foot barge. And I was working in the engine room, right fresh out of boot camp, and I had no place to go, particularly at the end of the day, so I worked a lot of extra hours doing the overhaul of the engines and whatnot. And every day when the captain would leave the ship, there was a catwalk above the engine room, and he'd walk through and talk occasionally. And one day he said, "Hey, I got orders for engineman school. Do you want to go?" And I said, nah, Captain, I'm really hanging on for aviation school. And of course, there was always the battle between the brown shoes, as they called them, black shoes, the Airedales and the the non. So he expressed his feelings on the whole thing, which I can't repeat now. But 2 weeks later, I had orders to go get a flight physical, and that went through okay. And we were then, I think we were on our third trip, and I was 2 days out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And orders came through for me to go to aviation school. So it was a lot. The captain saw that I was working real hard. And even though I wasn't going to become an engineman, he decided that he'd help me out. So he did.
So once you had taken care of everything else, what was your first air station? Was Traverse City?
No, first air station was up in Annette, Alaska.
Oh, that okay. Gotcha. So
then down.
Yep.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, then. Then down to Traverse City.
Right.
And 2.5 years there. And we did a lot of patrols out of Traverse City. In the wintertime, we'd take off out of Traverse, and it was usually a 7.5-8 hour flight. We'd cover the Great Lakes making charts of the ice. And then we'd land in Duluth, which has got to be the coldest place in the world. And we'd hand off the maps to whoever it was up there, and they in turn would send them out to all of the captains on the Great Lakes, so they know where to avoid the ice, or where all the ice flows were.
Wow.
And then the next day we'd reverse and go back into Traverse and reissue all the maps again.
What were you guys flying then?
The old Grumman HU-16.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
So, but the whole time that I was, when I got up to Annette, I got qualified on the Albatross, as we called it.
Yep.
And then, halfway through my tour there, I got also qualified on the helicopter, the H-52 that we had in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I maintained my qualifications on both aircraft until I got down to Miami.
There's a few people here that came in and left when I was at SeaGas Chicago, and you were one of the most unforgettable characters, because I was pretty well. First of all, colorful language always, but the other thing that I was pretty well convinced that the coffee cup was basically surgically attached to your hand.
Yeah. Well, you can't have cold weather. It's part of me. I always have a coffee cup, no matter where I was stationed, but especially up in the cold weather.
Yeah. We had some great times there, and you were there, so you were from 80 to 81? You were there at CSU?
I was 78 to 81.
78 to 81. Okay. All right.
So, I made chief up there.
Right.
And,
I remember that.
I went through the making chief, as you know, there's the initiation process.
Yeah.
And for most people, you're at, for Airedales, you're at an air station, so it's all people that you know and work with and everything. But at Chicago, there was just two chiefs. So our good friend Carol Dickman went over to the Navy and said, hey, I got this guy making chief, and we party with y'all, and that was that. So I was initiated with 17 Navy chiefs and a CB.
Oh, that's
and cool. It was a day I'll never forget. All of the Navy chiefs are in khakis, and I'm in my blues. And all I heard all day long is, "Where's that coastie at?"
So when you left Chicago, you're off to Miami?
I made chief in Chicago, then transferred down to Miami. And, but you know, one of my greatest experiences when I was in the Coast Guard had to have come the summer of 80. I come into work one morning, beginning of May, and our admin officer said, go home and pack your bag. You're leaving. Where am I going? I can't tell you.
Huh.
How long? I can't tell you. Just come back. Well, is it hot or cold? It's hot.
Uh-oh.
So I went home, threw everything together, came back, and he said, here's $500, here's your ticket, you're going to Key West. But that was when Castro opened up all of his prisons and crazy houses and just allowed everyone to leave. And we got down to Key West, and the Navy gave us a small piece. A lieutenant commander from Clearwater was the officer in charge. He met me at the airport and said, "This is what we got. This is what we have to. This is what we have to work with. If we need any more, just do the Coast Guard thing."
Right.
So we needed furniture and this and that. And here, people had come from all over the Coast Guard. There were two or three people from every air station. And, you know, a few of us knew each other. But for the most part, it was all just a bunch of strangers. And the way that everybody just fit in and worked together, it was, you'd have to go flying, okay, grab this helicopter that's out there. The crew is on, you know, they're taking a day off before they head out to the ship. And the way that everybody just worked together and pitched in, and we set up a an air detachment there, and we just did some great things. We saved a lot of lives, and, you know, the way that everyone just worked together was absolutely phenomenal. And it goes to show nothing, I mean, anything in the world can be accomplished if everybody's willing to work together. Yes. And it goes for the training that we all had. We all worked in the same way. We all flew in the same way. Our, you know, our maintenance was all done the same way. So you could just hop in the airplane and go and feel safe that you were in a quality aircraft. That's what we always did. But that had to have been one of my greatest experiences with the Coast Guard.
You also have a distinction. I can't remember what happened, but you're like a guy that has a designation. Was it the Lifetime Albatross Award or something? What is this?
I was supposed to retire at 28 years, but I got an extension for 2 years. I was on my third tour in Miami. And we were hot and heavy into narcotics and all the rest of it. So I asked for an extension, and I was granted. And about 6 months later, there is an honor that is bestowed on the most senior aviator in the Coast Guard. There's one for the officer and one for the enlisted. And it is Ancient Albatross.
There you go.
So about 6 months after I was into my 2 year extension, the reigning Albatross, who was the Master Chief of the Coast Guard, put in his retirement request. And so he had to turn it over to the next senior aviator. And they solicited. And if you think you're in the right category, you put in a request, and it came back a little while later that, yes, I was. So I was designated the number 3 Ancient Albatross. And it was great. I mean, a few things came up during the time that didn't allow me to do everything that I wanted to. But it was a great honor. You had a leather skull cap and glass, the goggles, and a white silk scarf and a full-length leather jacket.
Wow.
Quite a garb.
Did anybody get pictures? Because I've never seen those. That would have been something.
I have one that I will send you.
Send it, because that's like a poster somewhere, Chief.
It is.
You must have one or two events, Gary, where you came out of there with your back wet going, well, that was a close one. Anything come to mind?
I'm... You know, there is nothing, and I thought this when I went in, and my mind has never changed. There is nothing more honorable than saving the life of another human being.
Mm.
And on Facebook, just I don't know, a couple months ago, one of the other crewmen on there, they said, you know, I think about the memories of the people that I save. And I read it, and it kind of popped into my head. Yeah, the ones that you saved are always very memorable. But the ones that you didn't, there was one in particular. There was a family and they had left Houston in a big 47-50-foot cabin cruiser, mother, father, and five children. Mm. And they kind of skirted the coastline coming east, and they got to Pensacola, and instead of following the coastline, they just decided to go straight down to Tampa. A squall kicked up, the waves got rough, and the boat hadn't been out of the water and inspected in like 4 years. And the caulking fell out of the seams, and the boat sank. He put a call to Mayday in about 11 o'clock at night, and they launched out of Mobile. And I got a call about 4 o'clock in the morning to come in, and we were going to launch out another airplane. So we got airborne just at daybreak, and we found the boat within an hour or so. And the family, they didn't have a dinghy. They had this huge boat with no dinghy, and all of the family was in the water, and they were surrounded by sharks. All they had was this small life ring. We got an Air Force helicopter to come over, and they picked up two of the kids, and we followed them into the beach, and they transferred the kids to us, and we were going to fly them to the hospital. And they were 4 and 6, and neither one of the kids made it.
Oh.
And this was back in 1975, and I still remember their faces to this day. So it's good to remember the ones you saved, but the ones that you didn't are the ones that stick in my mind the most.
I'm thrilled to add a new voice to this this podcast. Gary Butler, who you all heard just in this episode, suggested I talk to Pedro Blanco because he is on active duty now with the United States Coast Guard, and he is an ME, which is Maritime Enforcement Specialist, and that's a billet that didn't even exist when I was back in the Coast Guard when Ronald Reagan was president. He was also born in 1994, and I'm pretty sure the shoes I wore today are older than he is. But Pedro, thanks for coming on.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled. And Gary's like, you got to talk to Pedro. Now, he was telling me that you guys met a few years ago and he helped you kind of find your way into the Coast Guard. Then he reconnected again.
Yes, actually, it's all because of Gary Butler that I am where I am today. Like, he is my mentor. He is my friend. I am so glad I ran into him a little bit over 3 years ago in the airport. And he basically guided me and advised me, and I am where I am today thanks to him.
Mm. So where are you today? You know, that vocation in the Coast Guard, Maritime Enforcement Specialist, you said, we talked just briefly before I turned on the tape, that just came around in 2010. That's something really new.
It is. It absolutely is. So before that, prior to that, the making of the rate had been in the works for a couple years. Before, we had all sorts of rates, like bosun's mates, machinery technicians, mm-hmm. and pretty much anybody else who was interested in law enforcement. And in 2010, the Coast Guard decided to create a rate of its own, specifically for law enforcement. And we have many different units and capabilities in the ME world. We go anywhere from DSF, which is Deployable Specialized Forces, such as MSRT and TACLITS. We're also attached to sector boarding teams, which is where I'm at. There's also MEs and cutters and in stations. And it's great. It's awesome. I love it.
So how does your day usually go? How do you guys roll out? So you're on a small boat and you're boarding other small boats, or how does that go for you?
So usually for that, what you just mentioned, those are the stations ME's. They usually take care of recreational boardings and whatnot. But for sector boarding team, we basically do high interest vessel boardings. We basically board the big container ships that comes into our harbors,
mm-hmm.
and we do security boardings sometimes. We do security boardings on them, check documentation and whatnot, and that's basically the bread and butter of the sector boarding team. And we also work along other LE agencies in the area. and do joint operations and whatnot.
Well, do you think people would be surprised, Pedro, the amount of stuff that comes through the waterways of the United States? And you're handling this stuff, you know, on those big container ships. But for years, obviously, you know, you see this now and again in the headlines where, you know, some cutter caught up with the druggies and there's a bust. But what about the rest of it? You think people would be surprised on how much has to be covered by this billet in the Coast Guard?
Oh, man, it's every time we go out, to do a boarding, like, it's our responsibility to prior of those vessels coming in to, you know, do our security boarding, make sure everything is intact. And it's just millions and millions of dollars of merchandise and oil, all types of containers, like of all types of supplies in our hands, waiting for our go to come in. They won't come in until the captain of the port gives the clear. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty big responsibility.
What's the most difficult part of the responsibility that you have? I mean, you know, you can't cover everything, can't catch everything, but, you know, you have a directive. What's the most difficult part of that directive?
Like the most difficult part of our job?
Sure.
I shouldn't disclose that much information, but in regards to the HIVs, the high interest vessels, when they're in our top list and something unusual, we get into some type of usual activity going on, we have to basically nip it in the butt as fast as we can and take care of the situation ASAP for that. And determine whether that vessel is going to be allowed to come in or not.
Mm. Well said. I could read through the lines. Well said. You did good. What's the most rewarding part of what you do?
Honestly, for me, personally, as an ME, I'm in love with a counter drug mission. Like it's what I loved when I joined. When I started working with other MEs as a non-rate before I chose what I wanted to do in the Coast Guard. I got some experience in counter-narcotic missions, and it's very rewarding. It's amazing knowing the amount of drugs that we stop coming into this country, because I see what drugs can do to people, and that's one of our top missions.
Mm. You know, back in the day, I'm just going to rewind to 1980, 14 years before you were born, but most of the stuff was usually in Miami, and sometimes you'd hear stuff in L.A., and I know that wasn't the only two places that stuff was coming into the United States, but that was really the gist of it. And now, you know, it seems like that the mission of the Coast Guard has expanded so greatly, even though it's still the smallest of the armed forces. So how stretched are you guys? I mean, you know, last year I was pissed. I'll be honest with you. I was pissed last year. I mean, the last people you want to hold a paycheck back is the United States Coast Guard. They are the last line of defense. And so, you're still the smallest service, and yet you do so much. I mean, that's truly an amazing accomplishment.
It really is, especially everything that you just mentioned now. It especially applies when the non-rate part of your career. As a non-rate, I was attached to a national security cutter. It's actually one of the newest cutters in the fleet. I was it was a great experience. I was stationed out in Hawaii, and we wear many different hats, and it could get stressful because other units, like, for example, you know, I'm a sector boarding team, like everything that we do is law enforcement 100%, but mm-hmm. other units like that I've been part of, you know, it could be, you need to be qualified in SAR, search and rescue, you need to be qualified in SLE. You need to be qualified in all these different types of things, and you got to do the job right. You're expected, and you're responsible to doing the job right. And yeah, I mean, being the smallest service, I that's one of my favorite things about the Coast Guard, actually. How small and unique we are, and how much we do, and that's another big part of how rewarding it is for us, of all the different hats that we wear, and how good we do the jobs.
Is it a pretty safe bet that you're a career man, or do you think that you're going to, you know, do 10 or so and then go see what's in the private sector? What does it feel like now? How long have you been in?
3 years now, a little bit over 3 years. I actually graduated from boot camp in 2017, and a career is definitely what I foresee for now. I do see myself doing this for 20 years or so, but you know, you never know what can happen. But I love it so far.
Well, listen, man, you've added a dimension to this podcast that none of us could talk about. We're just a bunch of old broken down coasties living off our memories. I can say on behalf of everybody I've talked to, and especially coming from me to you personally, thanks so much for your service, brother. You know, it is.
Thank you.
It really is such a, almost like a time warp from the days Gary and I knew each other to where it's at now. And I know, everybody else listening to this knows that we're in really good hands. So thanks so much for what you do.
Thank you for your service. I know that it was a different Coast Guard back when you were in many different ways.
Yeah.
I know. I've heard the story.
Yeah, most of the stuff we did, you guys could never get away with now, but that's a different show, Pedro. Different show.
That's exactly where I was going with.
And finally, to wrap up this 230th celebration of the United States Coast Guard, mostly as it pertains, as you heard, to the men and women that I serve with at Coast Guard Air Station Chicago, I wanted to take just a few seconds and remember those who have crossed the bar and are no longer here with us. This is a partial list, I'm sure, because you lose track of people over the years. Rod Leland was mentioned, who is just an incredible guy. He is no longer with us, as is Commander David Corson. Jeff Mini Butts Butler. When Gary Butler was there, he was Maxie Butts. And when Jeff was there, he was a tiny guy. We called him Mini Butts. Boy, oh boy. Clyde Sweet, who made Chief when I was there, passed away a couple of years ago. The lumber wagon, Keith Roth, who Mike Hicks was talking about, passed away. And just recently, unfortunately, a really incredible guy, George Ferguson, he was Fergie to all of us, has also crossed the bar as well. So for them and all the others who have served over the years and given their lives, from 1790 all the way to 2020, Semper Paratus, gone but not forgotten.